Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I'm Vice President of the National Press Club and Editor-at-Large at Bloomberg Business News. Special welcome to the club members and their guests in the audience, as well as those watching on C-SPAN and those listening to the program on National Public Radio and the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind club members of our upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, tomorrow, Herbert Kelleher, Chairman of the Board, President, CEO of Southwest Airlines, will present a speech entitled My Life as an Airline Commissioner. On Tuesday, June 14th, Bianca Jagger, a longtime human rights activist, will talk about the global refugee crisis. On Wednesday, June 15th, Mstislav Rostropovich, music director of the National Symphony Orchestra, will talk about current conditions in Russia. Audio and visual tapes of press club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-500-9911. That's 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards that you have on the table. Pass them up to me and we'll ask as many as time permits. I'd like to introduce now our head table's guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. On my left, your right, John Robinson, Defense Daily. Joanne Kelly, Reuters News Service. Richard Bernard, Executive Editor, Defense News and Space News. John Mintz, Washington Post. Jonathan Salant, Newhouse News Service. Howard Banks, Bureau Chief, Forbes Magazine. Skipping over our speaker, Christy Wise, freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Hale Montgomery, Washington editor, GPS World Magazine. John Morocco, senior military editor, Aviation Week and Space Technology. Frank Mooring, managing editor, Aerospace Daily. Ralph Vardabedian of the Los Angeles Times. And Pat Sloyan of Newsday. Also, I want to give special thanks to some of our staff members, particularly Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdo-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Norman R. Augustine, Chairman and CEO of Martin Marietta Corporation, a company that's a neighbor of ours here in Bethesda, Maryland. If you've been listening lately, you might have heard the crunch of consolidation in the defense industries as legends such as Ford Aerospace, Sperry, Grumman, LTV, and others were absorbed by other companies. Throughout all of this, Mr. Augustine has been on the buy side with the acquisitions of satellite builder GE Aerospace last year and rocket maker General Dynamics this year. Martin Marietta is now among the top three defense companies in the nation. Mr. Augustine tried recently to add Grumman, although he didn't quite pull off that deal. Still, our guest speaker heads the world's largest aerospace electronics company. Martin Marietta may top $10 billion in sales this year. It's 51st on the Fortune 500 list. It employs 96,000 people. Being at the top is not an unfamiliar role for Mr. Augustine. If we took time to read his exhaustive list of accomplishments and honors, we wouldn't have time for questions, much less answers today. So let me just pick out a few pertinent features here. He served two tours of duty in high civilian posts in the Pentagon, has four times been awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the Defense Department's highest civil decoration. In one of his stints of public service, he served in 1990 as head of the Advisory Committee on the Future of the U.S. Space Program, more commonly called the Augustine Committee, so it would fit better in headlines. The committee's recommendations for strong support of both manned and unmanned NASA missions, and especially a stable base of funding for NASA programs, make pertinent reading even today. Mr. Augustine is on the boards of numerous corporations. He is a member of the National Academy of Engineering. He's a restless world traveler, a wit, and has written 2 books. He also is the author of Augustine's Law, which he formulated in the 1980s as after years of observation. It holds that tornadoes are caused by trailer parks. It's now 1 hour past high noon, the foreboding title of Mr. Augustine's talk today. So, whither goeth the defense industry? It's showdown time for our speaker, Norman R. Augustine.
Well, thank you very much for that gracious introduction. I'm reminded of an introduction that was afforded to a good friend of mine, David Roderick, when he was chairman of U.S. Steel. On that occasion, it was said that David was one of America's most gifted business people. To prove it, the introducer had cited the simple fact that David had made $1 million in California oil. David came to the podium. He was obviously a bit embarrassed. He said the introduction had been essentially true. He said, actually, though, it had not been California, it was Pennsylvania. It had not been oil, it was coal. It had not been $1 million, it was 10,000. And it was not he, it was his brother. And he didn't make it, he lost it. So I hope my description of the defense industry today will have a better outcome than that. It is an honor to be with you, and I do appreciate the chance to speak with you about a situation that I think is of considerable importance to our nation. And let me acknowledge at the outset that my comments do come from the perspective of one who's spent a decade in 5 different assignments in the Pentagon under 2 different presidents, one from each party, and who spent 25 years in the defense industry. Over the course of these assignments, I've seen enormous changes in our industry, but certainly nothing like the tectonic shifts that are taking place today, seemingly with our various companies located firmly astride the fault lines. I would like to use this opportunity to offer some recommendations about how we as a nation might cope with these new circumstances. To do that, I'd like to return to the reference point that for several weeks has been the focus of countless newspaper, magazine, and broadcast media stories, namely the 50th anniversary of D-Day, a day which was pivotal not just for our armed forces, but for the subsequent course of American and world history. The reporting is focused on the meticulous planning that preceded the landings, the significance of the invasion on the course of the war, and certainly on the extraordinary bravery of those who fought and died. And the coverage has been very somber, reverent, and certainly very moving. No one can visit Normandy and the cemeteries there or stand on the cliffs and look down on Omaha Beach without being profoundly moved. But there is, I believe, a larger issue that often gets overlooked, and that's the recognition that, in the words of Newsweek columnist Robert Samuelson, World War II was a preventable tragedy, and in this sense, its occurrence represented an immense political failure. He went on to state that Hitler could have been stopped many times before he unleashed history's greatest slaughter, in which an estimated 55 million people died. D-Day became necessary when the Western democracies were very slow to recognize the danger at their doorsteps and equally slow to stop it. Mr. Samuelson's observations were made in discussing Professor William O'Neill's masterful book, A Democracy at War, which chronicles America's involvement in what some have called the last good war. Now, in fact, of course, it was not a good war. The term itself is an oxymoron. No rational person could regard a conflict involving wholesale death and destruction as good. But there can be no question that it was necessary, necessary to preserve our way of life. And in this sense, the war reflected what I believe is an all too recurring pattern of American behavior. It's a behavior driven by what one might call America's high noon complex. Americans have generally been reluctant warriors, and the desire to avoid even preparing for the possibility of war has been prevalent throughout our history. Despite George Washington's assertion that the best way to avoid war and to preserve peace is to be prepared for war, nonetheless, the size of our army was reduced from its 11,000 people in 1778 to a grand total of 80 soldiers just some 6 years later. And even our cultural icons in America seem to reflect this basic aversion. Like the townspeople in the movie High Noon, we strenuously avoid conflict, we tend to be slow to react to obvious danger, and we rise to defend ourselves and our allies only when it becomes unavoidable. But unlike the movie, we don't have a Gary Cooper to call upon to fight our battles for us. One might ask why we are so reluctant to defend our interests in a sometimes brutal world. Perhaps it's because we're a nation made up largely of immigrants fleeing persecution and violence. Perhaps it's because we've considered ourselves protected by two vast oceans from the troubles of Europe and Asia. Harry Truman characterized America as not a warlike nation. We do not go to war to gain territory. We go to war for principles. And yet, seemingly time after time, despite our best efforts, we found ourselves at war. And I think the pattern has been quite predictable. Step one, the United States wins a conflict, having fielded a superior force, usually with the most numerous and occasionally the most capable equipment. Our country stands as a leader of the world's democracies, setting terms for the peace that follows. Step two, the prospect of enduring peace causes us to disarm to a point where our military capabilities become incompatible with our ambition to influence international events or to deter certain of those events. Step three, growing tensions among other peoples leading to conflict create frustration. As we try through moral suasion or economic pressure to mediate disputes and to try to change very deep-seated attitudes. Step four, belatedly, we respond to the increased international danger only to be shocked by unexpected violence, such as a surprise attack at Pearl Harbor or the invasion of an ally, such as Kuwait or Korea. And step five, finally, roused to action, the country mobilizes. It sets out to meet the now unavoidable threat, and after the loss of precious lives, emerges victorious, and thus the cycle tends to begin again. Now, by this analysis, D-Day was preordained. Throughout U.S. history, our reluctance to recognize the need for a sustained, viable military has severely handicapped our fighting forces. In World War I, the majority of American troops reached Europe in British transports. They fought with French and British artillery pieces. They fired French ammunition. They flew Allied planes. And they manned French tanks. Of the 23,000 U.S. tanks that were on order, only 76 were delivered by the time of the armistice, and that after we had slogged our way from trench to trench across Europe and lost about 117,000 lives in the process. Following World War I, we reduced our military capability drastically, believing that we had fought the war to end all wars. The fledgling aircraft industry saw 90% of its capacity disappear almost overnight. The world was eventually assured that through political maneuvering, we would enjoy peace in our time. This, of course, proved tragically incorrect as World War II unfolded against a backdrop of broken promises and repudiated treaties. And after losing more than 400,000 lives in World War II, we yet again slashed our forces. And barely 5 years later, we were nearly chased off the Korean Peninsula by a third-rate military force. Historians have noted that our military projectiles simply bounced off the advancing enemy tanks. We had a new generation of armor on the drawing boards, but very few tanks of any generation in the inventory. Scrambling to find something to repel the North Korean invaders, decommissioned M26 Pershing tanks sitting on concrete pedestals around Fort Knox were taken down from their mounts and shipped directly into combat. And by the end of that war, the cost was 54,000 lives. Today, I believe the familiar pattern may be occurring once again. Step one was the demise of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and the victory over Saddam Hussein and his forces in the Persian Gulf. Step two was the precipitous cutting of the defense budget, which has caused procurement to drop by some 67% in constant dollars and procurement for our Army by nearly 80%. Today, defense spending is at the lowest fraction of the gross national product that it's been since just prior to Pearl Harbor. And step three was suggested recently in Jane's Defense Weekly, which counted 27 military conflicts in the world, 12 flashpoints, and 31 areas of tension. Step four, the half-hearted buildup to overcome earlier excessive reductions in order to deal with an emerging threat is not yet here. But a call for our forces to enter combat could, of course, come at any time. A month ago, Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn suggested three possible threats: a Libyan attack on the U.S. Capitol with canisters of anthrax spores smuggled in by diplomatic pouch, a nerve gas missile assault by a resurgent Iraq on Kuwait, or a nuclear attack on our 37,000 troops in South Korea. A haunting reminder of the nature of the world that we're entering was suggested by the Indian Minister of Defense in his comment about the real lesson learned from Desert Storm. He said the lesson was, never fight the Americans without nuclear weapons. Now, some would dismiss these and other hypothetical events as sufficiently remote that they can and perhaps should be disregarded. And those projections may even be right. But who among the world's leaders would have predicted the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, the invasions of Korea or Kuwait or Afghanistan or the Falklands or the attack on Pearl Harbor, or a host of other unexpected events that have arisen during this past century? As General Schwarzkopf wrote in his book, if someone had asked me on the day I graduated from West Point where I would fight for my country during my years of service, I'm not sure what I would have said, but I'm darn sure I would not have said Vietnam, Grenada, and Iraq. Yet the New York Times recently ran an editorial urging that billions of dollars in additional cuts be taken from the defense budget, saying that after the success of Desert Storm, it's obvious that U.S. weapon systems are unrivaled, so production of new tanks, planes, and ships can be put off for a decade or more. Ironically, these are the same weapons that we've been told for so many years were too complicated, too expensive, and too poorly designed to perform in battle. What's so often overlooked is the fact that in today's era of the come-as-you-are war, where outcomes can be decided in a matter of days, the only equipment available to our troops will that be that which was planned and provided during the decades before. The systems that performed so well in the Persian Gulf largely represented the technologies of the 1960s and the development of the 1970s, the manufacturing of the 1980s, all used by the people of the 1990s. So that is, the decisions of the 1970s to a very considerable extent determined the casualties that we incurred in the Persian Gulf. Now, we've espoused a strategy of minimizing casualties as well as offsetting a much smaller force. America's army is now tied with Pakistan for the eighth place in terms of the size of its army. We've espoused a strategy of fielding the most modern military equipment, but in actuality, our military hardware is now on a replacement cycle of about 54 years. This in a world where the technology half-life is somewhere between 2 and 10 years. And if you think back to the civilian products that were in use 54 years ago, when radios still had vacuum tubes and commercial airplanes had propellers, television was a novelty, and the principal computer was a slide rule, space travel was the province of science fiction writers. Well, today, as America seemingly repeats its high noon cycle, three key paradigm shifts have further complicated our national security planning. The first of these is the interconnectedness of the world economy. While the threat to Main Street certainly remains highly unlikely, the threat to Wall Street and other key economic resources are a good deal more plausible. In my personal opinion, the principal threat in the years ahead will be posed by a renegade nation holding a city hostage with a nuclear weapon. Other threats include attacking the world's energy or monetary or transportation systems, or as a variant, abusing our humanitarian instincts to such an extent that we feel we cannot remain detached. And in each of these latter cases, we could also be faced with nuclear weapons, which would dramatically raise the price of any response that we might wish to consider. The second key difference today is, in fact, the potential ability of many more countries to field weapons of mass destruction. As former Defense Secretary Elliot Richardson recently observed, there are so many unemployed Soviet nuclear engineers and scientists, some incidentally earning less than $30 a month, who are now potentially available to other countries seeking to develop a nuclear capability, we are certain to see a migration of that expertise. A recent Wall Street Journal article noted that such engineers were quitting their jobs for the more lucrative profession of street peddler. Lest we assume that only individuals are tempted to play the nuclear card, the Vice Prime Minister of the Ukraine at one point had threatened to sell any nuclear weapons on his soil to the highest bidder. Just this past weekend, as you know, India tested a new ballistic missile, and the North Korean government is reportedly developing a new missile with a range of 1,800 miles, which would be capable of reaching most of Japan and parts of China and Russia. The third key difference today is the telecommunications revolution, which has made, as you know so well, instantaneous news a way of life. On the one hand, it brings the promise of freedom into places where tyranny is dominated. And on the other hand, it's become an effective intelligence and publicity resource for third world despots. Last fall, we had the spectacle of a Somali warlord eluding United Nations forces while he calmly gave interviews to CNN. So what's all this add up to? Obviously, the world is still a dangerous place. And this might seem to be a lead-in to the predictable call from a defense industry executive that we're not spending enough on defense. But I'd be the first to argue that the end of the Cold War has fundamentally changed the nature of the threat, and further, that America should not spend money on defense simply to preserve jobs. It's quite clear that the post-Cold War world, America can afford to safely shrink its defense posture, and of course we've been doing exactly that. I believe that by my calculations, the 1 millionth defense worker will lose his or her job on about July 4th of this year. And this reduction of defense expenditures has made it possible for our nation to reap a long-sought peace dividend. One measure of this dividend is that more than $400 billion in real purchasing power has already been diverted from defense budgets to other purposes since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Disappointment over what some have characterized as a seemingly modest impact of this reduction stems from the fact that non-defense federal spending is now growing at a rate that far outstrips any plausible reductions in defense spending. The entire defense budget is now roughly equivalent to the interest on the national debt, or about one-third of what we spend on health care. America should, of course, spend no more on defense than it needs, but America can afford whatever defense it does need. In that regard, we today spend more on legalized gambling than we do on defense, more on beer and pizza than we do on our Army, and more on tobacco and soft drinks than we do on our Navy. But I believe that an equally important question that needs to be asked is, how are we shrinking defense? There was a statement a few weeks ago from Senator Cohen that the Pentagon spends $2.3 billion on administrative costs to process travel vouchers of $2 billion. This obvious inefficiency has been considered newsworthy, but it really shouldn't have been. According to Vice President Gore's National Performance Review, there are roughly 700,000 federal employees whose job it is to check up and audit others. My own research a few years ago noted that the defense procurement process is governed by 30,000 pages of regulations issued by 79 different offices, with direction provided by 29 congressional committees and 55 subcommittees, all monitored by a force of overseers the size of an Army division. As a result, everyone is responsible for everything, and no one is responsible for anything. Another example of flaws in the system was recently highlighted by the Congressional Research Service, which noted that the defense budget is being used as a checking account for programs that have nothing to do with national defense. Such very worthy programs as AIDS research, prostate and breast cancer research, museum support, broad environmental compliance, and even the Goodwill Games are now the wards of the defense budget, consuming more than $40 billion over the past 5 years alone. General Denny Reimer of the U.S. Forces Command recently told a Senate subcommittee, "We spend more on environmental programs than we do training the 1st Cavalry Division." What America should spend on defense depends upon the national objectives we wish to seek, and importantly, those which we're willing to forego, what risks we're willing to take, and what resources we're prepared to devote to national security. I note with some concern that we seem now to be in the process of inventing a new kind of hollow military force, one whose funds for modernization are so out of balance with the size of that force that it ultimately is likely to find itself ill-equipped, just as in the past we've built forces that were ill-trained or ill-supported. But making choices about national objectives and risks is the province of government policymakers acting on behalf of the American citizenry, not of defense industrialists. And thus, I'd like to devote my remaining few minutes not to what we devote to national defense, but rather how we spend it. In particular, given the basic aversion of Americans to think about and plan for conflict, and given the reality of sharply constricted defense budgets, and given the growing turmoil among nations, how do we avoid another high noon? And more specifically, what can those of us in the defense industry do to be helpful? In that regard, I'd like to send an urgent message to my colleagues in the defense industry in the same manner that the administration has called for reinventing the government. I believe it's time that we reinvent the defense industry. First, we need to get on with the job of building a newer, smaller, more efficient, but still effective industrial base. Too many companies still are practicing rearview forecasting. If we want to achieve the critical technological advancements that will be needed, as well as to avoid the burdensome costs of half-filled factories and laboratories, we'll have to speed the process of consolidation and downsizing. We'll have to decide whether our companies best serve the nation and our stockholders and our employees by being buyers, sellers, consolidators, or independents. These are tough, emotional decisions, not without risk. But they're decisions that are best made in anticipation of, rather than reaction to, market pressures and national security needs. The muddle of the road approach is simply no longer viable. Second, the industry must display the discipline and courage to make substantial investments in research and development, even in the face of smaller contracts, growing cost pressures, and impatient markets. Every breakthrough in the history of warfare, from the stirrup to the crossbow, from the jet engine to stealth, has spawned newer technologies which counteract the original innovations. And third, while we modernize equipment and products, we also must modernize our management. We have to empower our employees to give them the authority to make operations more efficient while continuing to improve quality. We must ensure that despite the loss of so many experienced workers, we don't lose the precious resource we have, the irreplaceable human skills and the expertise that provide our technological edge. And we most certainly must find ways to more rapidly transfer technologies and products both into and out of the defense sector from the commercial marketplace. Now, if industry is to accomplish these objectives, it will need some help from its principal customer, the government. Among the needed steps, in my opinion, are first to escalate the current effort to fix the $100 billion defense acquisition process, which everyone knows is hopelessly inefficient and complex. Let me add in that regard that a bill addressing some of the inefficiencies is being considered this afternoon on the Senate floor and will hopefully move to the House shortly thereafter. And it's a tribute to the efforts of Secretary Perry and several key lawmakers that we're finally beginning to see some progress on this long-standing issue. But the progress is barely a starting point. Returning to the list of needed steps, second, we must continue to push for revision of the antitrust laws to further greater industry consolidation while preserving at least a minimum level of competition wherever possible. Third, our government should be prepared to share with companies willing to make investments that produce savings for the government a portion of those savings. And fourth, we should not cut funds for defense-related research, exploratory development, and prototyping, particularly high-risk, high-payoff pursuits of the type which helped American technology the best in the world. Fifth, we need to restore truth in funding so that the American people can be assured that funds included in the defense budget are actually spent on defense. And sixth, we must stop the de facto nationalization of the defense industry that's occurred in recent years as more and more maintenance and repair operations are being expropriated by the armed forces at the expense of the private sector and as increased regulation is applied. And finally, we should build on the recent effort to level the playing field with our international competitors, which have traditionally enjoyed highly favorable relationships with their own governments. There's also a role for the average citizen to play in redefining our national security posture. The American people need to better understand the dangers that lurk today throughout the world, posed by people who would do us grave harm if given the opportunity. We're no longer, if we ever were, an island unto ourselves. It's no longer acceptable, for example, for two-thirds of the American public to believe that we are protected by ballistic missile defense systems, when in fact we, of course, have none. We must be vigilant to see that our national security interests are addressed, while at the same time exercising great discipline in assuring that our commitments and our interventions are never allowed to exceed our realistic military capabilities. I'd close my comments this noon on a message of hope. I do believe that we can break the high noon cycle that we've been caught up in throughout the two centuries of our nation's existence, but to do so will require the dedicated efforts of our industry, our government, and by the American people. And coming back to D-Day, which has so dominated our recent thoughts, I can think of no better advice to give defense reformers than General Eisenhower's order that launched that most massive military operation in history. Okay, let's go. So with that, I would thank you very much for the opportunity to share these thoughts with you today. Thank you.
President Clinton, in his budget, said no more cuts in defense. Is that too little, too late, of support? How do you rate the president's commitment to military preparedness?
Well, I heard the president mention about a year ago that America has cut, in his words, as best as I recall them, America has cut defense as far as we can and perhaps too much. And I think I would share that view. I believe his position of no further cuts is a very appropriate one, and I would not argue strongly with the magnitude of the overall cuts to date if we go no further. But I would argue with the allocation of those cuts, where I think we've created an imbalanced military, one with where we have too large a force for the amount of modernization we can afford. There are obviously at least two solutions to that problem. But I really do think we need to address the balance of the force that we're building with the funds that President Clinton and the Congress have elected to make available.
How How prepared is the defense preparedness industry for civilian conversion?
Judging by history, one would have to conclude the industry is not very well prepared. The traditional solution to downturns in the defense budget, this is the fourth one I've lived through, although certainly the most profound one. The traditional solution has been to seek to abandon defense and move into commercial fields as far from defense as one can. I've characterized that effort in the past as being largely unblemished by success. And there are good reasons for that. Just as one might not expect the world's foremost maker of toothpaste to be able to put spacecraft on the moon, as the defense industry does, why should we be able to expect companies that put spacecraft on the moon to be able to sell toothpaste? Neither knows the other's markets, transportation problems, research problems, financing, competitors, and so on. So I'm not the least bit optimistic about future success of the defense industry at moving far afield from things it already does. Now, of course, we can go buy toothpaste companies, but there's no value added. It's not clear to me that helps anyone. Probably hurts the toothpaste company. On the other hand, I do think it's possible, and we've had some great successes, some in our company that were described in the media this morning, in fact, where we have been able to move into closely related areas to our areas of expertise, into markets where we deal with large customers that we tend to understand. So I think our industry needs to, in general, stay away from consumer products and focus on high-tech products where we deal with large customers and selling major systems. Just an example, the one I alluded to that was discussed this morning. Our company some years ago had developed a computer and software algorithms that could be put in the nose of a missile or carried on an aircraft and could be used to detect targets for the military. It could tell a tank from a truck or from a cow or a bridge or what have you. And that same technology today will be used to read fingerprints, where we'll be able to search the entire FBI file in just a few minutes. This opens great new possibilities because we've all read of many cases where an individual was stopped by a police officer for one reason or another. There was no way the police officer could know there was a warrant for this person's arrest. The person was released, and the person within an hour or so committed a serious crime. There have been examples right in this area in the last few days. With this kind of a system, we'll be able to know right away whether that person should have been detained. We're using, I might say, much the same technology to help read mammograms with a considerable degree of success. So there are possibilities, but the notion that we can rebuild jobs in the defense industry as fast as the budget can be cut, I think, is one that's not realistic.
You mentioned the fingerprint business. How imminent is that endeavor becoming a viable business, or any of the other civilian applications you mentioned?
Well, the a number of these things are becoming viable. The fingerprint one in particular is in the stage where we're doing what you might call advanced laboratory experiments. It will still be a time before something like that is done in the field, but the basic technology, I think, is very, very much in place. There are many other examples of industries that have been spun off from defense over the years. Some have reached a considerable degree of maturity. One that would come to mind would be the space communications industry, where now a number of firms build spacecraft that carry a major part of the telecommunications around the world, and particularly to parts of the world where they don't have the resources to provide copper wire or silicon wire. And this is, I think, a very promising kind of application.
Do you see any advantages in teaming with foreign aerospace defense firms for future DoD programs? If yes, what countries do you believe have any technology that Martin Marietta would be interested in?
I should probably say, first of all, that with regard to, one should never really confuse the provision of military equipment overseas with selling toothpaste overseas, that selling military equipment is a very significant action and should be controlled totally by government policy and not by what people and companies can or would like to do. Having said that, once approved by the government, I do think there are important possibilities of cooperative agreements between companies in other countries, allied countries, and ourselves. And our company, in fact, is involved in any number of this kind of relationship. Some argue for relationships where the companies literally go together and own each other, the companies merge together. We're seeing that in Europe. My own belief is that we're better served, at least in America, certainly in the company I have the privilege of serving, I think we're better off to build relationships on a case-by-case, product-by-product, technology-by-technology basis, where we create joint ventures or partnerships, and to avoid the rather broad broad ties. As I say, there have been examples that have been quite successful in this regard. With regard to the second part of the question about what countries are promising, there are any number of very promising countries today to work with. One of the interesting things I find as I travel around the world that technology, both civilian and military, is diffusing very, very rapidly. So you find pockets of great capability in sometimes unexpected places. One of the greatest pockets of software expertise I've run across is in Bangalore, India. Certainly the European countries, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, one can name many, and I'm leaving many important ones out, allies such as Australia and Canada being obvious, have very important technologies that I think we can build upon and share, not only for military applications, but certainly for commercial applications as well.
Europe's defense contractors have tended to coalesce to a point where there is one national company in each segment of the business. How far can or will the U.S. defense industry go in this direction?
At the end of World War II, if I may use aircraft manufacturers as an example, there were about 20 manufacturers of fixed-wing combat aircraft in America. That dropped to 11 a couple of decades ago. It was 7 a couple of years ago, and today it's 4. Submarine manufacturers were in danger of having one or none. Tank manufacturers, danger of one or none. My belief is that we can't afford to have large numbers of manufacturers with half full factories, because the costs of having empty factories there will simply consume the defense budget. And I think as a nation, we can't afford that. So I do think we're better served by bringing half full factories together in one plant and make the tough decision to close the other plant. I like that solution as long as you don't get below two manufacturers in a given area. I think if we lose competition, we lose a very great deal for this country. Certainly to have 20 manufacturers is better than two, but I think 20 is not a lot better than 10, which is not a lot better than three or four. Certainly two is the minimum. If you get below two, then our industry will clearly have to become a regulated industry, even more regulated than it is today, more like a utility. And I think when you get in that situation, you lose the benefits of the free enterprise system that have served this nation and our industry so well. The real danger in my mind is that we may get to zero in some cases. And in that case, we may see a tendency or a trend to nationalize the defense industry in this country. And I think that would be tragic for national security. So my belief is we need to consolidate, hopefully never below two providers in any one market. And I'd prefer more if we could afford it, but I'd rather have few strong competitors than a lot of weak ones. And I'd like that both in the sense of competing against them. I'd rather compete against a strong, reliable competitor interested in the long term than one which is on the edge of the cliff. I refer to that latter as competing against the cross-eyed discus thrower. They seldom win any gold, but they sure do keep the crowd on their toes. And similarly, if I were in government, I would much rather deal with a strong company with good financing that wanted to be around in the long term than one that was being kept alive mainly by the prowess of its legal department. So I think that the big problem is going to be falling below two in some areas of military equipment.
Well, speaking of consolidation, since you lost out on the Grumman deal, are there other acquisitions you have your eye on? And I'll give you a follow-up question. Having lost out in the Grumman competition, does that mean Martin Marietta itself is in play?
Let me answer the second one first. The answer is no. With regard to the Grumman circumstance, that was one where we had reason to believe that we had a strategic relationship put together with Grumman that the two companies' managements and board felt was in their best interest. That, of course, didn't work out. We recognized the possibility it might not work out, and before submitting our bid, we had an agreement that if our arrangement did fall apart, we would be paid $50 million plus our expenses, and I'm happy to say that we've received that check. As to the future, yes, it is likely that we'll consider other acquisitions if the prices are right. Consolidation will become more difficult in this industry, unfortunately, for two reasons. One is that the price of defense companies has begun to rise again. 4 years ago, you could buy a defense company for $1.50 per dollar of sales. It got down as low as about 25 cents, and today is back up somewhere around 75 cents. So the prices are rising. Secondly, our government is unfortunately placing certain impediments in the way of consolidating the defense industry. This in spite of the fact that the last two secretaries of defense have made it very clear that they want the industry to consolidate. So those factors will make it more difficult, but yes, we are interested in continuing to consolidate. And to address the last question a little less facetiously, certainly our company is not in play. We are not for sale. Our company has been around for 85 years now, has a very strong balance sheet, very low leverage. And some of you may recall in 1982, another company did attempt a hostile takeover of our company, and we proved to be rather prickly on the subject.
Can you tell us anything more about which companies you're looking at?
My general counsel has assured me that if I answer that question, I will go to jail, so I think I'd better not. Thank you.
Martin Marietta continues to lay off employees. When do you expect the defense business to stabilize so that layoffs, at least for a while, will stop?
Certainly from an industry standpoint, the greatest tragedy of what we've been through and are going through has been the impact on employment. As I mentioned, our industry is down a million employees, very nearly. Our own company has lost about 60,000 employees. And I might say these are largely very talented people, very well-educated people, gifted in high technology. We're long past the point that we're losing people that were on the margin. We're losing people who are very able people to whom we owe a great deal. That's the great disappointment. Is it over? No, it's not over. And the principal reason it's not over is even if the defense budget is not cut further, and I'm not optimistic that that'll be the case, I suspect it will be cut further, but even if it is not, the lag time between budget authority, about which we generally read and hear, is sufficiently long, the lag time between budget authority and actual outlays that fuel the industry, is sufficiently long that it's my belief that my prediction of the mid-1980s, when I said that the bottom would be in about 1997, I really see no reason to change that mind. I think we're approaching the bottom, but we're not yet there.
One other question on the Grumman situation. At that time, you were going to inherit Grumman's research into maglev, magnetic levitation trains. Do you still plan to pursue this non-defense area?
We do have some work underway in that area. And I might mention that the portion of General Dynamics that we recently acquired. It does some superb work in various types of magnetic applications. Maglev does seem to me to be a long-term promising undertaking of the kind that could serve our industry well. So yes, we will continue to pursue it in a very deliberate manner, trying not to get ahead of the market. And I might comment too that that group at Grumman was a very skilled and is a very skilled group, and I think is a very significant asset to the new Northrop Grumman.
Has the space station been cut back so much that it will achieve little and should therefore be canceled? And secondly, do you approve of NASA involving the Russians in the space station program?
Well, those are both very difficult questions to deal with briefly. With respect to the degree to which the space station has been cut back, I did have the privilege, as was mentioned earlier, of serving on a committee that looked at the NASA program. And we had recommended at that time that the space station was far too complex, too costly, required too much extravehicular activity to assemble it on orbit. And we suggested that it be simplified greatly, redesigned, if you will. That's been done. Unfortunately, it's been a couple of other times since then and once before that, such that there are engineers in this country who have spent a third of their career redesigning space stations and still haven't got anything to fly. I think space station today is at a point that it's still very useful. I think it's an important program. I think it's the centerpiece, the keystone of the space program. I very much support it. And I say that even though our company does not have a particularly huge involvement in the program. But I do think we are very near the point where further cuts in the capability of the space station will bring into serious doubt its utility as compared with its cost. So I think we still have a very viable program, but I would be concerned if we go much further, we probably should just stop and devote the money to something else. With respect to the Russian involvement in the program, that is an issue that, if justified on the basis of political considerations, which I think it can be, should be, I think it's very appropriate to have a joint space program, space station program, with the Russians and with others, as indeed we do. I say that, though, principally because of the political ties it brings, and also I think the fact that it's very much in the interest of this nation to assure that the Russian economy survives. And if we can help in any small way by joint space activity, I think that's very appropriate. Having said that, I think it's also very important that we realize why we're not doing it. It's sometimes argued that it'll save us a lot of money. I have yet to see a joint international program that saves any money when you're done. And I suspect NASA is going to receive a considerable surprise when they try to treat the Russian government as they deal with U.S. contractors in terms of getting hardware and reports and equipment and monitoring and so on. But I think it's worth doing. There's also a danger we can go too far in letting our space program become overly dependent on any other nation. And that would be a concern to me. And I've raised the question, for example, if we were to launch U.S. spacecraft on Russian launch vehicles, strictly to save money, U.S. Civil space spacecraft, say, simply to save money, well, if that's the criteria, and indeed the Russians can produce launch vehicles much more cheaply than we don't pay our PhD engineers $30 a month. If indeed low cost is a criteria for the launch vehicle, then so too should it be the criteria for the spacecraft. And that would suggest we should buy the spacecraft from Russia as well. And if we were to buy both the launch vehicle and the spacecraft from Russia, then perhaps we should also have them operate it for us, since they would know more about it, certainly launch it from their facilities. And one soon arrives at a point where we build American flags and put NASA stickers on it and mail them to Moscow with checks. And I'm being extreme to make my point. So I think there's a balance in terms of involvement in these international programs. But for political reasons, and basically for political reasons, more than for technology or economics, I think that that particular program is justified, and I certainly would strongly support it.
Back at home, how do you rate the chances for significant reform of the acquisition system in Congress?
I tend to be rather optimistic at this point that we will see some reform in the next few months. Hopefully we'll see action in the next week in the Senate. The reform that's being addressed is very important, and we have kind of an unusual alignment of the planets, where we have a vice president taking a personal role in this. We have a Secretary of Defense who you couldn't possibly think of an individual in this country better equipped to deal with the subject. And the same is true of a Deputy Secretary of Defense and the person in charge of acquisition and OSD and the Office of Secretary of Defense and so on. And we have people in the Congress, Senators Glenn and Senator Bingaman and Senator Nunn and many others who are devoted to this very arcane subject. So I think we will see legislation, and I think it'll be constructive. I think that the legislation now considered will solve maybe 5% of the problem. The other 95% of the problem doesn't have to do with such arcane matters as specifications and thresholds for contract types or protests or awards or RFPs. What the other 95% of the iceberg has to do with is the turbulence in the acquisition process, the turmoil. We hear a lot about the waste in toilet seats and coffee pots. That's not where the waste is. Where the waste is in starting programs, stopping programs, accelerating programs, stretching programs, canceling programs, changing people, changing requirements, changing priorities. There's big money being wasted in that area. And so far, we haven't addressed that, and I truly hope we will.
Switching subjects to you, should we take military action in Haiti?
I suspect this is way beyond a question that anybody from the defense industry should even pretend to answer, but I would be very, very circumspect before I would involve us in Haiti if it were my decision. I feel equally strongly about a couple of the other trouble spots in the world just now. It's certainly Haiti has a country with great troubles and great problems, and we certainly have the military capacity to deal with that issue. But were the decision mine, I think I would be very reluctant to involve us at this point.
Before we reach the final question, it's our pleasure to mark this occasion with a couple of gifts here, a certificate of appreciation and a press club mug.
Oh. My goodness, it's empty, though.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you very much.
And we both survived. This is his first appearance before the National Press Club, and it's my first introduction. So we have a common bond. But before you do leave, we have one final question. What was your punishment for attempting to steal the clapper off the bell on top of Princeton's Nassau Hall?
Oh, my goodness. somebody's been tracking my history. As a freshman, there is a tradition, which I was later told by the dean is only a tradition if you don't get caught, where you steal the clapper from atop Nassau Hall so that no one could be called to class. And a group of my colleagues and I did manage to steal a clapper. Unfortunately, one of my colleagues fell through the ceiling of the dean's office in the middle of the night. The dean wasn't present. And we were caught, and the dean indicated to us that we had done more damage to Nassau Hall than the British had when they shelled it.
Thank you very much, sir.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNet Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.